Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of today's show. The rest of today's show is available for download and on-demand listening at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
This is a complicated situation. We have been very clear with the Afghan government that the freedom of religion and the freedom of religious conscience is at the core of democratic development. They have constitutional expectations that have been written in that they will, in fact, live up to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which protects individual conscience on religion.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice invoking the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights from the United Nations. She was trying to put pressure on Afghanistan not to execute a man charged with apostasy for converting to Christianity while he was in Europe. Rice spoke on Fox News Sunday. And with that, we begin the week as we usually do, talking Monday morning politics. Today with political columnist Dante Cini of the Christian Science Monitor and later NPR's Juan Williams. Among our other topics, confusing signals from the administration on withdrawal from Iraq, the immigration policy debate at a crucial point, and more. Hi, Dante. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, thanks for having me on again.
Explain the Afghan situation and why this man might be put to death, as you understand it.
Well, this is basically a difference in what we see in democracy and what they see in democracies. This is a man who was a Muslim who converted to Christianity, and that isn't allowed. It's not accepted or not acceptable in the Muslim faith, particularly as it's interpreted in Afghanistan.
Well, and I think as it's interpreted is a key point here. And I'd like to open up our phones right away for Muslims to weigh in on this. I'm sure you've seen this story in the news. It's causing discussion around the world. It's causing some in the West to question anew whether Islam and democracy are compatible. So I wonder if any Muslims want to call in and tell us your understanding of when and whether and if ever someone who converts to Christianity from Islam should be put to death under Sharia law, at least as written. 212-433-WNYC 433-9692. And Dante, I do understand from what I've read on this that there are different interpretations. So some people say, Muhammad once said that, but it's not in the Quran. And so there are different levels of orthodoxy on this.
Right. I mean, we're dealing with religion here. I mean, this is as we see with almost all religions, there are differences of opinion. I mean, obviously, this is a very stark case, but there are differences of opinion as to what is right and what is wrong. I mean, we have our differences, again, not quite this dramatic, but in a lot of people, what Christians believe, the Bible tells them. And this gets very complicated, and I don't know, when we start talking about whether Islam is compatible with democracy, I don't really know if that's the issue. The issue is Islam compatible, or is Islam, at least particularly the way it's being practiced in Afghanistan, compatible with what we think democracy needs to be? I don't want to get into the game of moral relativism here, okay, but there are things we feel just are right and have to be part of democracy. The thing is, we think that everybody else should think that too, and they may not.
Right. Well, the Afghan constitution in and of itself is an interesting experiment in democracy in that it says all laws in Afghanistan must be consistent with Sharia law, but it also says all laws in Afghanistan must be consistent with the UN's Universal Declaration on Human Rights. And here is one example where those two things, at least by some people, are interpreted to be in conflict.
Yeah, well, I think there's going to be an inherent tension whenever you say something like that. When you're trying to serve two laws, trying to serve two masters, it's very difficult. I, 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 you know, I do think this is just the beginning. I mean, this is a question we're going to be, you know, it's going to capture a lot of headlines, but I just think this is the beginning of this. I think, or this is just the one that's caught the attention. I think there are all sorts of issues that are going to be on the periphery that are going to call these things into question about where does the government in Afghanistan really stand on these things?
Right.
Or if we get a government, or a real working government in Iraq, we're going to be looking at the same kind of issues there.
Right. And in this case, it's this one particular court, which brings up whole other questions of democracy, of, you know, independent judiciaries. In this case, this judge may see himself as independent from what President Karzai or those others in the central government who might not like this idea want. And so that brings up another issue. But let's take a phone call. Here is Jane in Roslyn Heights. Hello, Jane.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I am calling only because, as a Muslim, all of this way that this religion is portrayed in the media and reported just makes me feel so angry and so bad, because there is nowhere in Islamic law that says you cannot become a Christian or change your religion. In fact, the Prophet Muhammad actually said you should explore and study all religions before you decide whether this is the right one. They say the only thing that they Muslims are against are people who are idolaters or who have no religion, that do not know God. It just makes me crazy when I hear this. This kind of stuff has to do with politics. This is not a part of the religion.
So how do you explain this judge?
I have no idea. This is so political. There's so many people in the Muslim religion that absolutely make interpretations. In Iran, there was actually a mullah just before he died that actually admitted that he had written and made pronouncements that this is part of the Muslim religion, that it wasn't at all, that he had made them up out of whole cloth, and he admitted it on his deathbed.
Huh.
This is so often the case. If you really go and read the Quran, and if you go and read about the foundation of this religion, you don't see any of that. Even our media says that the Muslims say there is no God except Allah. That's nonsense. It's there is no God except God. There is no Allah except Allah. It just is the name of Allah, is just the word for God. And what they were saying is there is no God except the one God. It was so that you wouldn't worship idols or multiple deities.
Jane, thank you very much for your call. Dante, anything you want to say?
I understand the reason that Muslims would be upset about the way this is being covered. But again, I would say that, you know, these are questions of religion, and look, religion interpretation, this isn't confined. There are a lot of Christians who would tell you that they don't think their faith is covered properly either, and they would say that, you know, you're misinterpreting what's in the Bible, or different sects of Christianity misinterpret what's in the Bible. I mean, this is the sticky wicket of religion, which is ultimately about, you know, journalism is about finding out what's going on in the practical world. Religion is about, you know, for the people who practice each faith, truth, ultimate truth. It gets very complicated. If there is something that's more difficult to cover than religion, I don't know what it is.
Dante Chinney, Christian Science Monitor, political columnist, my guest on WNYC. We'll also be joined a little later on by NPR's Juan Williams as we talk Monday morning politics here on WNYC. Let's take another call on this. Nadim in New Brunswick, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Nadim.
Good morning.
So what would you like to say?
You know, this is Nadim. Good morning, Brian. You know, the thing is this, whatever is media is saying and telling about this conversion from Islam to Christianity, I think that may be a view of a certain radical group, but nowhere in Quran, nowhere by the preachings of Muhammad, nowhere by Islamic views, there is no restriction. They have the liberty to read and understand other religions, but I think that the media is sort of exploiting one view of one radical group that may not be an educated Islamic view.
And yet there does seem to be a lot of enough power invested in this group that this execution may actually happen in Afghanistan.
But Brian, let me tell you this. There is something which is correct, there's something which is right, and there's something which is true.
Right.
There are three different opinions that in my personal view, I'm a born Muslim. I've been in the United States for almost 15, 20 years. I'm in the healthcare industry. And, you know, I may not be the best Muslim, but whatever I understand of religion, Islam, Quran, everything, and whatever, I think the essence of every religion is faith and belief in God. I think every religion has... In every religion, there are radical groups. There are radical groups which exploit all these issues. And what happens eventually when it gets to the media, it becomes a big explosive headline on the front page.
Yeah, just to jump in, I think that the thing that makes it very complicated is it may be a radical group, but when a radical group, like I say, what journalism covers is the practicality of things. It's the practical world. It's what's actually happening. And if a radical group seizes power and that point of view actually starts to have weight, you can't ignore it. It's hard to say this isn't a story. I mean, this is a legitimate story. I mean,
Yes, but I also understand his concern that this doesn't get oversimplified into this is what Islam says. And
absolutely.
So is the government of Afghanistan going to listen to Islam, or is it going to listen to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights?
I think that's right.
What our two callers have expressed is that, no, please don't say it's either Islam, which executes converts,
right.
Or something else. So, Nadeem, thank you for your call. By the way, it's interesting to me that Secretary Rice, several times in the last few days, has invoked the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which comes from the United Nations from 1948, and which says some very nice things about persons before the law, for example. And by the way, folks, if you want to read the actual UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it's relevant enough today that we have posted it right on our blog. So you can go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show to see the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Dante, Article 6, one sentence. Everyone has the right to recognition everywhere as a person before the law.
Yeah, that's where, as soon as you had, as you brought up this point, I knew where you were going with it. And it's a valid point. I mean, obviously we're talking about the way detainees are handled and whether or not they're enemy combatants and how they're treated before the law in this
country.
And
so similarly, Article 8, everyone has the right to an effective remedy by a competent national tribunal for acts violating the fundamental rights granted him by the Constitution or by law. And also in the, I think it's the Washington Post today, there's a story about Justice Scalia giving a speech in Europe the other day where he said no. Enemy combatants should not have any rights before the law.
Well, and Justice Scalia has a lot of views on a lot of things that that people consider inflammatory in various ways. But he has very strong opinions. But I do think that you have a very legitimate point when you start talking about, look, if we're going to start citing UN declarations and we're going to start talking about whether or not people should be treated such ways before law, this is the problem when you start playing that game a little bit, when you start saying, well, the law applies, but this is an exception. Because when other countries want to make exceptions, why are your exceptions valid and theirs not?
I want to play another clip of Secretary Rice, this time on NBC's Meet the Press. And I think we've heard some mixed signals in the last few days from her and the president on whether there's going to be a troop drawdown in Iraq. The president made headlines at his news conference by saying, not till the next president will there really be a decision on getting out of Iraq, but listen to what Secretary Rice said, referring to the commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, General Casey.
General Casey has talked about a significant reduction of American forces over the next year, and that significant reduction is because Iraqi forces are taking and holding territory now, because during this most recent uptick of sectarian violence, the Iraqi army behaved very, very well.
Dante, we have to take a break in 30 seconds, but are they giving conflicting signals, or do these two connect in some way?
I think ultimately they're somewhat conflicting signals. I think Condoleezza Rice, Secretary Rice, is ultimately saying we're going to begin drawdowns, and there will be drawdowns, but maybe they just won't be completed, because that's what the president was talking about, that we won't have no whether there will be any troops at all in the country is a decision for future presidents, but. Look, there is some people are going to see conflict there, conflicting messages, and this is not going to, in the political sense, this is not going to help in November.
I think we still don't know whether there's going to be some kind of major drawdown between now and November to help with that, but we'll pick this up in a minute, and NPR's Juan Williams will join us too, Brian Lehrer on WNYC.
providing the transportation, hiding them when they're here. If you do those kinds of things, knowingly, willfully, aiding and abetting, then you can be prosecuted.
This could be a fractious debate, and I hope it's not. Immigration is a very difficult issue for a lot of members, as you know. It's an emotional issue.
President Bush speaking the other day, and Congressman Tom Tancredo, Republican from Colorado, on ABC's This Week yesterday, talking about the bill in the House that would actually label as felons all illegal immigrants and the people who help them stay here illegally. And with that, we continue to talk Monday Morning Politics with Dante Cheney, political columnist for the Christian Science Monitor, and also with us now, NPR senior news analyst Juan Williams. Good morning, Juan.
Good morning, Brian.
So where does this situation stand now with the immigration legislation? We keep hearing that today is a crucial day in the immigration debate. Why today?
Well, in fact, as we're speaking, President Bush is at the White House here in Washington swearing in some immigrants to make the point that there's a need for some kind of compromise, some action. And the reason that today is so critical, Brian, is that Senator Frist, the majority leader in the Senate, has put pressure on his fellow Republican, Senator Specter, the head of the Judiciary Committee, to come up with a compromise bill. And if he said that if Specter doesn't do it by the end of business today, he will introduce a separate bill that is essentially a copy or mimics what the House has done, which is all about border security, more agents, even possibly building a wall, more high-tech surveillance. It's all crackdown rather than anything that involves allowing some of the people who are here illegally now to find a way to stay, or working with employers who have some of these people in jobs and who are a major constituency for President Bush.
And as I understand it, Juan, there are basically three versions of immigration legislation. One would make illegal immigrants and those who help them stay here illegally felons, as we were just describing. President Bush's bill, which creates a guest worker program that forces the guest workers to go home after 6 years, and the Kennedy-McCain bill that creates a guest worker program that is a path to citizenship. Is that about right?
That's exactly right. And the big difference is, especially for people who are that we've seen in the streets over the last few days in places like Phoenix, Los Angeles, Milwaukee, here in Washington a few weeks ago, is that if without a path to permanent residency, you know, what is it but essentially exploiting workers? They're making that case. So the unions, a lot of people who are with the illegal immigrants and as supporters are saying, essentially what you're doing is allowing Americans to exploit low-wage workers, big business to exploit them, without giving people any real hope. And they point out that most of these illegal immigrants are children and women. It's only like 2 million out of the 12 million are single men. So what you're talking about is families that are really trying to take advantage of, you know, America's economic and educational opportunities, and why is America out to punish those people? That's the kind of sentiment you're getting from that side. Of course, you know well, Brian, the heat from the other side is things like the Minutemen people charging that these illegal immigrants come in and they abuse our social safety net program. They put pressure on our tax dollars, on our schools. And they even are a threat in terms of terrorism. Health problems could ensue. And I think there's arguments here that are hiding some racial element to it as well. American identity shifting with so many immigrants. People worried that, you know, you're going to certain places in the country, nobody speaks English anymore. There's a lot of that to it as well.
You mentioned the big demonstrations. They took place in the last few days in L.A. and elsewhere. 500,000 is the going estimate for the turnout in Los Angeles. The size there and elsewhere surprised a lot of people, even the organizers, from what I read. Let's listen to a little bit of what the mayor of Los Angeles, Antonio Villaraigosa, had to say before an obviously very large crowd.
And we come together to say, that we are workers, not criminals. That we work hard, we pay our taxes, we live by the rules, and we want this great America to take us into account.
Mayor Villaraigosa of L.A., we are workers, not criminals, he says. Dante Cheney from the Christian Science Monitor, is it possible to say which of these three bills has the upper hand right now?
Well, I would think that, you know, the thing you'd always say is probably the middle road is the one that always has the best shot, because there's probably room to move. But I mean, Juan probably has a better read on that than I do. I do think the real issue with the guest worker program is the way that I see it is there's this whole talk about there are jobs that Americans won't do, there are jobs that Americans won't do, and I think most Americans would argue that that's a matter of pay. And when you're talking about one of the things with this guest worker program was that, you know, they're not going to have the same rules that we do in terms of even minimum wage. What you're talking about really doing is creating a separate pool of workers that are going to be paid a different kind of wage, and what jobs are going to fall into that category. If you make the wage low enough on most jobs, you'll find that most Americans won't want to be stockbrokers if it doesn't pay enough.
Juan Williams?
I think that's exactly right. The argument is that you let in a large pool of low-wage workers, and it depresses the market for people who are, you know, let's say high school dropouts or just have a high school education in this country and who would normally have to fill those jobs. They don't want the jobs at the rate that big employers are able to pay illegal immigrants who are desperate for any opportunity. But maybe they would take the job if it paid a better wage. And under the guest worker plan, as you just heard from Dante, they would not hold to the same minimum wage laws. Questions about exactly what protections would exist for these workers if they, for example, lost a job. Would they then immediately be deported? All of these questions are at play. But I think that there's a great deal of pressure. And I got to tell you, I'm being turned around on this as we talk. I thought that there wasn't going to be any action ultimately, that there's going to be a lot of debate. Immigration is a big issue in the country, in our society, in our culture. But I didn't think that there was a possibility of getting something done because the House obviously is so focused on border security, that above all. I mean, that's all they want to do. And then you have people like Johnny Isaacson, the senator Republican from Georgia, who said, you know, he just wants to build a 2,000-mile wall along the border. And I thought, well, that's going to drive the discussion and debate in such a way that it's not going to be possible to get either a guest worker program or the McCain-Kennedy bill, which would allow for permanent residency. But as I say, there's such pressure right now building and such pressure coming from the White House, from the business community, and from these marchers, that there may be concurrent pressure then on the House to act in some kind of pragmatic fashion and say, well, here's what's possible, and we'll get something out of this.
Let's, as it happens, President Bush is speaking right now, and he's using the opportunity to talk again about this immigration issue, especially with this expected vote in the Senate today. We're not going to take this whole speech, but let's listen in a little bit right now on what the president is saying about what he calls strengthening immigration laws. This is live.
Hardworking business owners should not have to act as detectives to verify the status of their workers. Next month, we're going to launch law enforcement task forces in 11 major cities to dismantle document fraud rings. We're working to shut down the forgers who create the phony documents, to stop the smugglers who traffic in human beings, and to ensure that American businesses comply with American law. The third part of comprehensive immigration reform is to make the system more rational, orderly, and secure by creating a new temporary worker program. This program would provide a legal way to match willing foreign workers with willing American employers to fill the jobs that Americans are unwilling to do. Workers should be able to register for legal status on a temporary basis. If they decide to apply for citizenship, they would have to get in line. This program would help meet the demands of a growing economy, and it would allow honest workers to provide for their families while respecting the law. A temporary worker program is vital to securing our border. By creating a separate legal channel for those entering America to do an honest day's labor, we would dramatically reduce the number of people trying to sneak back and forth across the border. That would help take the pressure off the border and free up law enforcement to focus on the greatest threats to our security, which are criminals and drug dealers and terrorists. The program would also improve security by creating tamper-proof identification cards that would allow us to keep track of every temporary worker who is here on a legal basis and help us identify those who are here illegally.
All right, President Bush speaking at a naturalization ceremony live this morning as the immigration issue comes to a head in Congress right now, and we're talking about it as our main Monday morning politics segment, or one of them, with Juan Williams, NPR senior news analyst and political columnist Dante Cheney from the Christian Science Monitor here on WNYC. And Juan, just that little bit that we just heard from the president really raises so many issues. For one thing, when he talks about guest workers then getting in line, explain what he means by that.
Well, in, under the president's plan, the guest worker plan, if they stay in the country, hold a job, can prove that they are in, are employed, can prove that they have paid their taxes, are willing to pay a fine for having been here illegally, then at the end of that period, they would be allowed to go back to their home country and apply for a green card. So they'd get in line behind people who had applied previously, but they could get in line. In other words, and the U.S. would acknowledge that these people had been here and had been served that time. Let's distinguish that, Brian, from the McCain-Kennedy bill, which would say that you can stay in this country after proving that you have a job, proving that you've paid your taxes and all the rest, and make that application. There would be a way to stay in the country and gain legal residency, and that's the big difference between what the president is proposing as his guest worker plan and what Kennedy McCain are proposing. But let me just say quickly that there are people on the right who say both bills amount to amnesty for people who have broken the law.
Now, let me jump in on that, because Senator Arlen Specter was out on ABC's This Week yesterday addressing exactly that point. And let's listen to Senator Specter on why this is not amnesty, in his opinion.
It is not amnesty, George, because these undocumented aliens are going to have to pay a fine. They're going to have to work for 6 years to be on the citizenship path. They're going to have to go through a criminal background check. They're going to be checked out very, very carefully.
So, Dante Cheney from the Christian Science Monitor, it is amnesty. It is an amnesty. Why is that such an important buzzword?
Well, I think amnesty, these are in people's minds illegal aliens, and the idea that somehow they've skirted the rules and they're going to get away with, you know, quote unquote, get away with it scot free and be able to get into the country isn't right in people's minds, I think. So amnesty is the wrong word. Whether or not this technically is amnesty, we can have that debate as much as we want, but you know, it's interesting to me. I spent last week, the end of last week, in Detroit, my hometown, doing some reporting, and the anger, the politics of this is interesting because the anger is palpable. I think everybody's aware of what happened last week in terms of the layoffs for the auto workers. And look, you know, when you go to these people and you tell them that it's not amnesty, but we're going to allow these people to, you know, quote unquote, these people to come into the country and stay here and work for less money than you're going to work and so on and so forth, it's going to create a lot of anger. And the politics of it are interesting because I think for the Republican Party, this is seen as a way to reach out to Hispanics primarily and illegal immigrants and say, you know, we're with you in some way. And I wonder how much good it can do the party, the Republican Party, politically in California, and what it would mean in terms of if that would be able to offset the loss you would have for the party in states like Michigan, Ohio, Illinois, Wisconsin. Now, you know, you could say Michigan went for Democrats in 2000 and 2004, but it was close.
It's certainly an interesting question, and California is considered the poster state for the Republicans getting politically on the wrong side of the immigration question. After Governor Pete Wilson, Republican, was seen as too tough on illegal immigrants. Juan, I wonder if you agree with this. That's seen as a watershed moment for California having gone sort of irretrievably into the Democratic camp.
Right. Absolutely. And
At least, national politics.
And for national politics, what you've got is, just looking back at 2004, one of the big differences that bumped President Bush on the way to victory was the fact that he increased significantly his margin among Hispanic voters.
Right.
And so as we look forward to 2006 and 2008, people like Karl Rove looking at the playing field, and they have clearly identified, mm-hmm. Going way back, when he was governor of Texas, the president understood the future in terms of this political dynamic is you have to get a toehold in that Hispanic vote. How do you do it? And they are right now under pressure, realizing that they will cede that vote if you get you know, 500,000 people marching in L.A., in New York, Phoenix, in opposition, you're going to say, oh, to the Hispanic community, you guys go back to the Democrats, which is exactly what happened after Pete Wilson tried to crack the whip and right. thought that he was playing to that right-wing base and it would get him elected. Answer, no, it didn't work.
And I in some districts, obviously, this is seen as such a strong issue for the Republicans on the other side, the side that feels embattled by too many immigrants, that members like Tom Tancredo are raising it right now. In fact, I want to play another clip of him from ABC's Meet the Press. ABC's This Week yesterday. You know, Hillary Clinton made headlines, at least here in New York, I think this was national news last week, saying that under this House bill, Jesus himself would be a criminal for aiding illegal immigrants. So how far does this actually go? Here's what Congressman Tancredo, Republican from Colorado, said on ABC.
Nobody is talking about prosecuting, nor have we ever prosecuted under the law while it was in existence, anyone for providing, you know, soup at a soup kitchen or a place of rest for somebody who turns out to be an illegal alien.
So, Dante Chitty, I actually think that was very artfully worded by the right. congressman at the end. Nobody's been prosecuted under the law when there was such a law in the past for providing soup at a soup kitchen or a place of rest for someone who turns out to
right.
be
right.
an illegal alien. What if they knew that person was an illegal alien?
Well, I think that's the question. That's a little more open. It seems to me that those people would be. It's, I mean, that was put in his words for a reason. Who turns out to be an illegal alien? It's if you're doing it unwittingly. I mean, now what I guess what the churches or what they could argue, what religious organizations could argue, is we just don't ask that question, and we take who we take, and you know, oh, you know, they did turn out to be an illegal alien. Oh, that's, I'm sorry to hear that, but we just don't ask that question.
And Juan, maybe not Jesus himself, but the Catholic Church is getting active on this issue on the side of immigrants, I understand.
Absolutely. You know, major constituency for the church.
Right.
And when you have a movement in order to protect illegal immigrants from abuse, I mean, we don't talk about that much because, as we were discussing, you know, most there are a lot of people who see them as illegals. They're, you know, it's criminal behavior. You're in the country illegally, but there's tremendous exploitation of that population. You could just start by the idea of being low wage workers, but there's exploitation, everything from prostitution to making them into mules for drug carriers to abusing children. In fact, in a recent case that got a lot of publicity in this country, a guy was abusing immigrant kids. So there's a lot of abuse, and that's why you have a movement among church people to offer protection for these families. As I said, most of them are women and children, which mm-hmm. sometimes escapes the attention here in Washington.
Juan, we're almost out of time, but I'm going to give you a quick last word here, and I wonder if today's Paul Krugman column in the New York Times is going to get caught up in this national debate. You might expect him to take a, you know, reflexively liberal position, which would be a pro-immigrant position, but he says modern America is a welfare state, even if our social safety net has more holes in it than it should, and low-skill immigrants threaten to unravel the safety net and other things like that. So Paul Krugman writing those kinds of issues up in his column, you know, shows the complexity of the question. 10 seconds.
Oh, sure. And in fact, Krugman's argument is it drives down wages because you make low-wage workers available to employers who then don't have to pay higher wages that would
right.
make those jobs attractive. So he's contradicting what the president says about
and
Americans not wanting those jobs.
In our second hour today, I'm going to read more of the Krugman column, and we're going to take your phone calls on it. So that's coming up. But Juan Williams from NPR, Dante Chinney from the Christian Science Monitor, thanks a lot to
You're
both
welcome,
of you.
Brian. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast of The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.